Welcome to the Science Podcast for October 14th, 2011. I'm Carrie Klein.
And I'm Stuart Wills. This week, artifacts left behind by Middle Stone Age artisans, NSF's attempts to clarify its not-so-clear peer review criteria, and mussels manufactured from carbon nanotube yarns, plus a few stories from our online daily news site.
Support for the Science Podcast is provided by AAAS, the American Association for the Advancement of Science, advancing science, engineering, and innovation throughout the world for the benefit of all people. AAAS, the Science Society, at www.aaas.org.
In South Africa, researchers have uncovered what appears to be a pigment-producing workshop in a cave near the Indian Ocean. But this isn't a modern workshop. The artisans in question occupied the cave 100,000 years ago. A team led by Christopher Henschelwood of the University of Bergen, Norway, argues that the artifacts found in Middle Stone Age sediments in the cave were in fact tools for mixing, grinding, and storing the brown pigment called ochre. That suggests that humans in Africa had an elementary knowledge of chemistry and the ability for long-term planning tens of thousands of years earlier than previously thought. Henschelwood spoke with me about the findings from Cape Town.
It's a cave site situated right on the edge of the Indian Ocean. It's about 180 miles west of Cape Town. It's a warm little cave. It's a very nice place to stay in. And I think this is one of the reasons why it attracted people over a long period of time. The oldest levels at the site are about 140,000 years old, and the youngest levels about 2,000 years old. But the site itself actually closed up. The entrance was blocked by sand about 70,000 years ago. So it actually hasn't been occupied for a very long time until very, very recently. So we are now looking at those older levels, which are beyond 70,000, and down to 140,000. And this latest discovery of this toolkit was in the levels dated to 100,000 years ago.
And that's the so-called Middle Stone Age. Could you talk just briefly about where human development stands in that particular time period?
We know that the origins of Homo sapiens, all Homo sapiens, lie in Africa. They evolved probably about 200,000 years ago, perhaps a bit earlier, from a physical point of view, to look very much like we look today, but we know very little really about their behavior, especially in the early stages, because finding sites that were occupied by these people is extraordinarily difficult.
Okay, so you mentioned that you've been looking at this particular site for quite a long time. I don't know how to ask this exactly, but were you surprised by this find? Is this something you were looking for, or did this come as a complete surprise?
I think that many of the finds we've had from the past from the site have come as complete surprises. We really don't know what to expect from these sites because we know so little about how Homo sapiens or how people behaved so long ago. We excavate the site extremely carefully, so the finds only come out very, very slowly. So it takes often many, many years to extricate one find. And I think you need to be patient to get to these finds, but you also need, you know, once you find them, to be very careful in taking them out. So once we had uncovered the whole toolkit, which we can talk about more in a moment, it was very exciting indeed. But of course, initially, we didn't really realize what we had.
Okay, well, we have the context of the site you've been excavating. Tell us generally about the specific artifacts that you're reporting in this paper.
We are reporting two toolkits, what we've called toolkits, which lay about 30 centimeters from one another in one level in the cave, one stratigraphic level. There's about 2.5 meters of deposits above these, which also were occupied by people at various times. The one toolkit is quite complex. It consists of a number of different items. The central part is a shell, an abalone shell, which has deposit inside it, a red deposit, which we've since analyzed and discovered it is, in fact, a compound mixture. And right next to, above and below this shell, were a number of items that were used to produce this compound. This is also the same case for the toolkit lying very close by, although the complexity of that toolkit is not as much as for the first one.
Well, you refer to these artifacts as toolkits. Toolkits, I guess, for producing this ochre. And the entire site in your paper you refer to as a 100,000-year-old ochre processing workshop.
Right.
I was wondering if you could talk a bit more about the lines of evidence that have led you to that interpretation, how you think this workshop might have actually functioned.
Right. We are looking, first of all, at the matrix. This is the sand that surrounds these two finds. And it tells us that there's very little else in the site at that time period. So what we surmise is that a few people came into the site, started producing, bringing in all these components, started producing this compound, and probably maybe spent a day or two at most, we think, and then left again. Because you would expect to find food surrounding these toolkits. You would expect to find the normal detritus that humans leave behind, which we have in all the other levels. But in this level, it's not the case. So it looks like they came in specifically to carry out a task, which is to produce this compound, this pigmented compound, and they then left. So, as I said, we really, from that evidence can surmise that these are, in fact, toolkits. They're also very compact. They're right next to one another, and the individual components are stacked right next to one another. So if you take keys apart, each individual toolkit, it becomes fairly obvious what each component was used for and how it contributed in the end to producing the compound.
Can you give an example of a component of the toolkit and how you might infer it was used?
Certainly, there are a number of them. One of them, of course, the key component is the ochre itself. Ochre is iron oxide, hydroxide. It doesn't occur in the vicinity of the cave. It had been collected. The closest source is about 20 or 30 kilometers away. It's a soft rock, generally red in color, can be yellow, and it's used as a pigment to stain something, either your skin or perhaps an artifact, something else. They brought this to the site. They then gathered also small round cobbles of quartzite, bone, specifically in this case a scapula from a seal, which they heated in the fire. We can see evidence of the heating to release the fat. The fat was obviously an important component of this mixture they were making, as was the bone. And they also put charcoal, probably from a small fire, into the mixture. So each of the components was used, first of all, in different ways, but the little grinders were used to grind the ochre to make a powder, because it occurs in the lump form. The powder was then poured off these into the abalone shell. They then added the bone, the seal scapula. This had been crushed and broken up into tiny, small, fatty pieces at that stage, of course not fatty any longer, added to the mixture, added charcoal. There's also some sand in there. This could have been serendipitous. We don't think it was necessary added deliberately. And then a mixture, a fluid. What the fluid was, we don't know. It could have been water. It could have been urine. It could have been a number of different things. And once the mixture was made, they then gently stirred this mixture with their finger. And we can see on the nacre of the shell at the bottom the outline of exactly how a finger would have pulled these tiny sand grains across the surface. It's left a little track. So you could actually see the action of the person who was making the mixture.
So basically we have really just a composite of lines of evidence, both from chemistry and from the stratigraphy of the site, if you will,
that
kind of all points to this outcome. It's a remarkable story, and if I'm understanding it correctly, one of the big deals here is that this is evidence of this kind of processing many thousands of years earlier than the earliest previous evidence. Do you think there are alternative ways that this evidence might be interpreted?
Would be hesitant to say so, because I think that the stratigraphic information is so clear. If you look at the finds individually and then break them down into their individual components, it's very obvious what they are. They can't really be interpreted as being something else. We have analyzed the mixture in each of the abalone shells, and the mixture is in fact the same. So clearly they're setting out, I think, with a recipe, with a predetermined idea of what they wanted to produce, and they've produced this in two different containers. I just don't see any alternative explanation, because why else would you bring these components in and make this mixture? We also have a little bone, it's actually an ulna from a canid, which was used to transfer the liquid out of these containers. It's just a very small little piece of paint, almost like a little paintbrush. The end of it is covered in ochre. It's very clear what they've done. They've dipped it into the mixture and then transferred the paint or the compound art in quite small quantities, perhaps to paint a surface, perhaps to do something else that we don't really know what. So I would think that the story is quite secure.
Okay, so what, in your view, does this story say about the development of Homo sapiens? What's the sort of larger significance in that context?
To my mind, I think the most important thing is that it's the first known instance for deliberate planning, production, and curation of a compound. And secondly, it's for the use of a container. The use of containers before this time period is unknown, as is the procuring and mixing a compound of, well, this is quite a complex compound. It's early chemistry. So for me, I think it casts a whole new light on early Homo sapiens and tells us that they were probably a lot more intelligent. Not that we've ever thought they were not intelligent, but probably more intelligent than we think. And we're capable, certainly, of carrying out quite sophisticated acts at least 40 or perhaps 50,000 years before any other known example of this kind of basic chemistry.
Christopher Hinshelwood, thanks very much.
Thank you very much indeed.
Christopher Hinshelwood is lead author of the paper A 100,000-Year-Old Ochre Processing Workshop in Blombus Cave, South Africa, published this week in Science.
In a news focus this week, Science Deputy News Editor Jeffrey Mervis discusses the long-running debate surrounding the National Science Foundation's at-times ambiguous peer review criteria, the requirement that applicants address the broader impacts of their work has left researchers scratching their heads since the criterion was established in 1997. Facing criticism from the community and a nudge from Congress, NSF plans to release a report to clarify the terms later this year. Jeffrey Mervis spoke with me about the story.
The way federal agencies judge the quality of proposals is a stressful situation for any researcher. But it's more confusing if they don't know how they're being judged. And what this story looks at is NSF's attempt to try to improve the definition of how it judges the 55,000 proposals that it gets every year.
And so on what criteria does it judge those proposals?
It has two criteria. The first one is called intellectual merit, which most scientists understand. It's basically how good is the research idea, how well qualified is the researcher to do it, does he or she have the facilities to carry it out? The second one is called broader impacts, and that's where all the controversy is.
So broader impacts, what exactly does that entail?
That's a great question. It's a phrase that NSF came up with in 1997, and it was intended to respond to criticism that NSF cared more about the academic community that it was funding than the needs of society at large. So this was an attempt to say, your research may be brilliant, but what value is it going to be to society? The tricky part is in defining what that means. A lot of investigators feel that means educating students, doing public outreach, somehow improving the quality of science education in the country. And that's true, but it's not just that. NSF has deliberately avoided defining the phrase because they don't want to stifle the ideas that investigators would have on how they are going to apply their research more broadly.
I can understand how that could be confusing and even frustrating for applicants. And so the NSF is being asked to define this criterion once and for all?
Well, it probably won't be once and for all. They began, as I said, in 1997, and every 5 years or so, the National Science Board, which is the oversight body for NSF, has felt compelled to try to explain what it means. A lot of investigators simply refuse to respond to it and feel that that's outside their area of expertise. In fact, at one point, an NSF director had to send out a notice telling people your proposal will not be reviewed if you do not address broader impacts. But saying that doesn't make it happen. And so in 2007, NSF drew up a list of examples of what could be covered by broader impacts. But even that wasn't enough. And so last year, the Science Board created a task force to try to clarify it once again. It's an issue that Congress is also interested in, and Congress gave NSF a push to do this. There's even a cottage industry where you can buy products that will allegedly help you get through the peer review process and get a better score and have a better chance of getting money. Obviously, NSF would rather that those efforts didn't need to exist. They would like their system to be transparent, and that's what's behind this new effort.
And so earlier this year was another attempt to clarify this. What did that entail, and what kind of feedback did they get?
So what happened was in June, the task force issued draft guidelines. And at the core of those draft guidelines was a list of activities that the board said would foster national goals. And those national goals included things like strengthening national security, improving economic development, as well as the more traditional activities such as broadening representation, improving science education, training the next generation of students, raising public literacy. And those guidelines were criticized, but from two different camps. One camp said you are diluting the importance of education, broadening participation, and public outreach. The second group said you are turning NSF into an applied research agency by focusing too heavily on national goals that will achieve economic development or national security. There was also a controversial phrase that the research itself could satisfy broader impacts, and there was a lot of confusion about what that meant. So the board got hundreds of comments, even though they had held lots of listening sessions and conducted surveys and had focus groups. And so they are in the process of revising that guideline now in hopes of addressing those criticisms.
It sounds like they're dealing with pressure from all sides here. So how are they going to address all of this in this latest effort?
Yeah, there is a lot of pressure. And what the board has said all along is we are not going to abandon broader impacts. What is going to happen is another attempt to clarify what the phrase means and to spell it out in a way that the board hopes will placate, if not satisfy, most of the community. So they're working on a revised version, which they hope will go to the full board possibly by December, although that's a self-imposed deadline. It may end up that they need to take more time.
Have we gotten any previews for how this report may be different from the last one?
Well, I think that they are likely to remove the list of national goals that the research is supposed to achieve and instead substitute a phrase that says those are possible outcomes from the research. It may seem like a semantic difference, but it actually is important. So that's one big change. The other is to emphasize a couple of underlying principles, one of which is that intellectual merit is of surpassing importance. The other thing that the task force is trying to deal with is the debate about whether individual projects need to satisfy broader impacts or whether they should be taken at a higher level. In other words, if an entire portfolio of research grants that NSF has funded in a particular area would satisfy broader impacts, or even if the entire group of grants that an university has received as a whole would satisfy broader impacts. And that is meant to address the feeling that a lot of scientists have is that they're not skilled or knowledgeable in some of these areas. And so the board is trying to walk a fine line between making sure that individual investigators take it seriously, but not requiring them to do things that are outside their area of expertise.
So do you think when this report comes out, will this be the end of the discussion?
I don't think so. As much as the board and NSF would like to feel that they have finally explained themselves, I think this is a perennial issue, and that may not be bad, because I think what research can do to help society is a question that needs to keep being asked, and the answer is going to change over the years. And so it's probably not a bad idea for NSF to keep coming back to it every so often.
All right. Well, Jeffrey Mervis, thank you so much.
Well, thank you.
Jeffrey Mervis writes about the National Science Foundation's peer review criteria in a News Focus this week.
In a study published online this week by Science, researchers have created artificial twisting muscles from carbon nanotubes. Ray Bachman and colleagues show that when the nanotubes are drawn into yarns and submerged in an electrolyte, the injection of charge causes the yarns to partially untwist and rotate more rapidly than other manufactured muscle-like materials. The result suggests that, much like muscles in living organisms, carbon nanotube yarns can use the properties of a surrounding fluid to create movement and change shape without structural support. Bachman spoke with me about the study from his office at the University of Texas in Dallas.
We've invented a new type of artificial muscle that's torsional, that provides motion which is rotational. This new type of muscle is based on carbon nanotube fibers. These fibers can be one-tenth the diameter of a human hair and can provide a work output per unit mass which is comparable to that of giant electric motors. In about 1.2 seconds, these carbon nanotube yarns can rotate a 2,000 times higher weight paddle up to about 600 revolutions per minute. The rotation per length of these new torsional artificial muscles is over 1,000 times higher than previous artificial muscles made by humankind.
Okay, well, let's step back and talk a little bit about these yarns, about what they're made of, how they're made.
The carbon nanotube yarns comprise individual nanotubes, untold billions of them, that are about 1/100,000th the diameter of a human hair. They're only about 10 nanometers in diameter. We make these yarns in a very unusual way. First, we grow what we refer to as forests of carbon nanotubes. We draw sheet strips from these carbon nanotube forests. We insert twists, just like a twist is inserted as you make wool yarns. This twist is extremely important for the operation of our torsional muscles.
You're kind of setting them up for rotational motion by twisting them at the outset.
Yes, definitely. Without this twist, they cannot function as torsional muscles.
So what else did you do to these things to turn them into these rotational muscles? I understand there's another step involving an electrolyte, or?
Yes. The electrolyte that is infiltrated into the carbon nanotube yarns is essential for success in making a carbon nanotube torsional muscle. So we need two electrode elements. We need a carbon nanotube yarn, which serves as an electrode. We need, second, a counter electrode, which can be almost anything. And we need a electrolyte in which both of these electrodes are partially immersed. And then we need a battery, a power source. Now, you can optionally use a reference electrode for control purposes, but it's not essential.
So could you sort of give a general explanation of how these things actually work? You've set up, you know, how they're built, but how do they actually work?
The actuation that we observe for these carbon nanotube yarns is very unusual. And the mechanism is quite interesting. As we apply a voltage between the carbon nanotube yarn and a counter electrode, the carbon nanotube yarn charges up electrically, just like the electrode of a supercapacitor. Now, as the carbon nanotube charges electrically, ions from the electrolyte move in to compensate the electrical charge, so overall the yarn maintains electrical neutrality. This inward flux of ions provides a volume increase for the carbon nanotube yarn, which causes the torsional rotation. Simultaneously with this torsional rotation, we see a contraction of yarn length. Now, at first, this sounds very surprising that if you increase the volume of a yarn, that it contracts. But the mechanism for this contraction can be very easily understood by thinking of the childhood toy, the finger cuff. Our carbon nanotube yarns have a helical type of structure, which is extremely important for their acting as torsional muscles. And similarly, the finger cuff toys have this helical type of structure. And the child puts their finger into the toy and elongates the helix, the finger's trapped. In other words, in this case, the process of elongating the helix makes the volume decrease. Inversely, which is the case when we charge the carbon nanotube yarn, if you compress the helix, then the volume increases and allows the child's fingers to be released.
Well, you alluded a bit at the outset about the performance of these artificial muscles. Could you give us a bit more on that, the kinds of speeds and torques you can get out of these things?
Usually, electrochemically driven artificial muscles are slow. These muscles, these torsional muscles, provide extremely fast rates. We attach a paddle, for example, to our muscles, the carbon nanotube yarns, and take movies of the rotation of this paddle. And we were amazed to find that in 1.2 seconds, the paddle is accelerated up to 600 revolutions per minute. We can get nearly a revolution per millimeter of nanotube length, which is about 1,000 times higher than previously reported for any type of torsional artificial muscles. And previously reported artificial muscles have been made using, for example, ferroelectric materials, conducting polymers, and shape memory metals.
And what about the force involved? I think you had some interesting comments on the torque, I guess is a better way to put it, on that compared with macroscopic systems.
The torque that we can generate per mass of the actuating yarn is comparable to that of very large electric motors. Also, the work that we can do in providing torsional rotation per mass of the carbon nanotube muscle is comparable to that of large electric motors. But as you downsize electric motors, you dramatically decrease the work capabilities per weight, you dramatically decrease the torque capabilities per weight of electric motors, and make the motors very expensive when normalized to, for example, output work capabilities. The muscles that we have, again, can be about a diameter of a hair or 10 times smaller. They can be extremely long and therefore generate very high rotations, or they can be as short as a millimeter. And still, even a millimeter length of our torsional artificial muscles can rotate a paddle about 360 degrees.
Okay, well, those sorts of statistics get us into the applications, and I was curious, you know, what sort of applications we should be looking at that use this new technique?
Well, the first applications are basically as microscopic motors for microfluidic circuits that could be used for chemical laboratories on a chip, for example, that can be used for analysis of chemicals, for sensing. Often you want to control the movement of fluids. You want to pump them from one place to another or turn off one flow and open up another flow on these circuits. And these carbon nanotube muscles, because of their very small size, seem very suitable for this type of application. In fact, we have made a mixer for a fluidic chip, albeit we haven't downsized it. The channels on the chips that we used were large, about 3 millimeters.
So it was sort of a proof of concept.
Proof of concept.
Ray Bachman, thanks very much for talking with us today.
Oh, thanks a lot.
You can read the paper, Torsional Carbon Nanotube Artificial Muscles, at www.scienceexpress.org.
Finally today, Daniel Strain, an online news writer for Science, is here with some of the latest stories from our daily news site. So, Dan, in our first story, we've got a snapshot of medicine from the 17th century.
Yeah, we have a project that is going to dabble in the medical records of a 17th century physician named Simon Forman. And Mr. Forman was, I guess character isn't quite the word for it. He was apparently a notorious sexual predator. He was an alchemist, and actually there are rumors that he also worshipped the devil. In addition to that, his physician practice revolved largely around astrology. He would take patients and hear their symptoms and get their histories and then make recommendations based on the stars. But this project does a bit to clean up his legacy, because while he may have been a bit of an eccentric, to say the least, he collected some of the most detailed medical records of the Elizabethan era.
So he certainly sounds quite unorthodox in his methods. What use are these records today?
There are apparently a lot of uses. A lot of researchers are fairly excited about this. So what this comes out of is a project called the Simon Forman Casebook Project. It was announced last week in England for Mr. Forman's 400th birthday. And what it's going to be doing is taking his extensive list of medical records, there are about 50,000 cases in all, and turning them into a format that's intelligible for people all over to look through and search. And historians are quite excited about it. It's going to be one of the most extended, most unprecedented looks at medical history in that era.
So if these medical records contain astrological data and medical data, I mean, I imagine there must be so much information in here. What sort of information did Forman record?
Yeah, well, despite being a quack, he actually took very meticulous records. They think he saw maybe around 30,000 patients over this several decade long period. And he noted pretty much everything about them, who their family were, their names, their ages, their symptoms. All of this was, of course, very important for him for recording their astrological history. But it's also something that could be very useful for medical historians.
And now we move from Elizabethan England to the Galapagos Islands. What are we studying there?
So this is actually quite a disturbing study, and it's a study looking at chick abuse by a type of bird called the Nazca booby. And this bird lives on the Galapagos Islands. And what actually happens is they see this very common behavior. These birds sort of nest together. A neighbor will often walk over to another bird's nest and start actually very viciously biting the chicks that are in that nest. And it can cause serious harm. Unfortunately, researchers have taken a very sort of close look at this behavior and showed the sort of long-lasting consequences for those abused birds.
And obviously, this sort of research has implications also for child abuse in humans.
It's a very well-known fact that, sadly, a lot of folks that are abused as children often wind up growing up to be abusers themselves. Scientists weren't just sure if this was a human phenomenon, however, and it actually looks like it is a phenomenon that can go into the animal world, namely for this booby species.
All right, so how are scientists able to actually study individual birds of these species? How did they set up this experiment?
So they followed this population in the Galapagos for several years, and what they did is they actually tracked these birds from chicks to adulthood. And what they found is actually sort of a tragic finding, is that the chicks that were sort of viciously attacked when they were young grew up to be birds that were more likely to be chick abusers themselves.
Now, this sort of behavior I don't think is particularly common in nature. Why do scientists think that this particular species exhibits this behavior?
Well, they don't actually know all that well. They think it may have to do with this bird's history sort of as chicks. What is very common in these boobies is that they'll lay two eggs in every nest, but they can only actually, in most situations, care for a single egg. So what you see is you get a lot of violence between chicks that hatch from the same nest, between siblings. They actually try to fight each other to be the one that gets taken care of. And scientists think it might be a byproduct of this. There's also some potential that being attacked as a chick has some long-lasting consequences in terms of hormone that actually increases aggression later on in life.
So how similar is this kind of abuse and these kind of long-term effects to those observed in humans?
Well, and that's a big caution of this paper, is that while it certainly seems similar, it's important not to jump to that conclusion right away. For starters, it's sort of interesting that human abuse, sadly, tends to be between a relative and a child. in these species, it's actually a non-relative or a neighbor, which is sort of an interesting different angle. And with humans, obviously, this behavior of sort of abused individuals often, not always, of course, but sometimes growing up to becoming abusers themselves, has to do with sort of very deep psychological sort of effects. Whereas scientists would say that in this particular species of booby, it has to do somewhat with how they're hardwired to fight as very young birds.
And lastly today, we've got another exciting advancement in stem cell research.
Yeah, this is actually a very neat, obviously it's not there yet, but it's a very neat sort of potential for folks that have a very dangerous particular type of liver disease. This disease is called alpha-1 antitrypsin deficiency. What happens is in a normal functioning liver, liver cells will produce a particular type of protein that actually travels to the lungs and protects the lungs from inflammation. Unfortunately, people with this very devastating disease have actually a mutation in that gene. They produce sort of faulty versions of the same protein that then tend to get stuck and accumulate in the liver. This can cause symptoms like cirrhosis, and actually many people have to wind up getting a liver transplant, so it's pretty bad news, and it's rare, but at least 100,000 people in the United States are inflicted by it.
And so how are stem cells being used in respect to this disease?
Well, this is a very fascinating look at a potential treatment for this disease, which is actually at the same time very simple. So to start off, what the researchers did is they took actually skin cells and they turned them into what are called induced pluripotent stem cells. These are sort of blank slate style cells, cells that are similar to embryonic cells that can grow into a wide range of different types of body tissue. What they did actually in these cells is they took faulty cells, cells that had this particular type of deficiency, and they almost did a bit of editing. What they did is they snipped out the faulty genes, and they actually put in the healthy versions of the genes that produce the good version of the protein. Then once they did that, what they're able to do is turn these stem cells actually into liver cells. So they turn this sort of blank slate cell into a liver cell. They injected them into mouse livers, and what happened is, very excitingly, for about 5 weeks after this injection, the mice actually produced this healthy form of the protein.
So is this a technique that can only be used for this disease in particular?
And that's actually what is exciting. The researchers point to the fact that it's a very sort of simple technique. I mean, it's more complicated than this, but it's a bit of cutting and pasting. And they suggest that it could have implications actually for a number of diseases that, like this particular type of deficiency, are caused by a single mutation in one gene. So able to take out these other faulty genes and replace them with well-functioning genes.
So is this technique ready for use in clinics?
No, it's a pretty far cry away from actually being tested in humans. One of the big considerations is obviously safety, and this is what the researchers are being very careful about. Because when you do this type of cutting and pasting work, you have the potential to introduce other types of mutations into these cells, and these mutations could be harmless, or they could actually cause effects like cancer. The researchers watched the mice that they injected these cells into, and they didn't see any signs of cancer, but that's not to suggest that it wouldn't ever happen. So they need to be pretty careful about what else is going along with these good versions of the genes.
All right, so what else has been in the news this week?
Yeah, also in Science Now, we have a new look at a type of snail that actually bobs along at the surface of oceans using what's basically an inflatable raft made out of mucus. We also have a DNA analysis that looks at the contents of amphoras, so ancient containers taken from Greek shipwrecks. And in Science Insider, we have an analysis of a new immigration reform efforts that could have implications for skilled workers, including scientists, for staying longer in this country.
Daniel Strain is an online news writer for Science. You can check out the latest science news and the policy blog, Science Insider, at news.sciencemag.org. And that concludes the October 14th, 2011 edition of the Science Podcast.
If you have any comments or suggestions for the show, please write us at sciencepodcast@aaas.org.
The show is a production of Science Magazine. Jeffrey Cook composed the music. I'm Carrie Klein.
And I'm Stuart Wills. On behalf of Science Magazine and its publisher, AAAS, thanks for joining us.